The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your usually bi-weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by IJ attorneys Anya Bidwell and Rob Piccola. Anya, you were at the Supreme Court yesterday. That's pretty cool.
United States Supreme Court, you have to say that.
The United States Supreme Court.
The United States Supreme
Court. You were there. What was it like?
It was really, really great. An experience of a lifetime. We had a really cool case in front of the justices. It involves durational residency requirements to get a license to sell alcohol and whether these requirements are constitutional. And it's essentially a battle of constitutional provisions, right? 21st Amendment that grants states power to regulate alcohol versus privileges or immunities of the 14th Amendment or versus the Commerce Clause. So justices tried to figure out whether how powerful is the 21st Amendment and whether you can discriminate when you have such powers.
So I think they said at argument that in any other setting, if you were to pass a law that would ban new residents or recent residents, recently arrived residents to a state from doing something that longer term residents in your state can do, in most contexts, that violates the 14th Amendment or the Commerce Clause. But this is alcohol, and that's different.
It's very interesting. There is a Supreme Court case on point, Science, and it basically says, yes, if you are a newly arrived resident, you have a right to be treated exactly the same way as an established resident who's been there for a while, and privileges or immunities of the 14th Amendment, privileges or immunities clause, grants you that right. But that's not what the Retailers Association of Tennessee thinks about this.
So we hear a lot about right-wing judges and left-wing judges. Was that a dynamic that was present yesterday?
Not at all. It was actually quite amazing to watch. Justice Kagan, Justice Alito, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Sotomayor, they all seemed to be on the same page. Justice Breyer as well, basically being very surprised by such outrageously long durational residency requirements and how they can still be on the books.
How long is the requirement in this case?
Essentially, it's a 9-year requirement. So 2 years in order to get a retail license to sell liquor, then the license only lasts for 1 year. So you have to apply to renew it. But then it turns out you have to be a resident for 10 years to renew the license. So you really can't start the process until you're in your 9th year of residency. Then you can get a license and after 1 year renew it. But not other than that. And by the way, justices thought that, you know, you can't sever the 2-year requirement from the 10. You have to take it as a whole.
That seems really insane that you would create
Thank
a requirement
you.
Like that.
Yes. And it looked like justices would agree with you on this.
Rob, you were not at the Supreme Court yesterday, but I think soon you will be because you're a great lawyer and you have cool cases. But as a consolation, why don't you tell us about our first case?
So our first case comes to us from the Ninth Circuit, and this case is about a graduate student, a Malaysian graduate student at Stanford, who encountered every traveler's worst nightmare, which is being told by the TSA that she could not board a plane because she was on the no-fly list, and ultimately being banned entry back into the United States and not even able to attend her own trial, really being put through the tortures of the damned. This is a case that went up and down to the Ninth Circuit several times before finally arriving on the issue that we're discussing, which is attorney's fees. And it was a fascinating glimpse into the way constitutional cases are litigated. And there were some real parallels with what she went through with some of the things that we encounter with our IJ cases. There were discovery battles where the government did everything that it could to withhold information about why she was on the no-fly list, which, by the way, she never actually learned to this day. It was determined that she was no security threat whatsoever and was still banned. And it really gave a glimpse into what constitutional lawyers have to deal with trying to get basic information. And ultimately, the court went through its balancing test, looking at the government's behavior throughout the course of the litigation and deciding that this is a case where not only are attorney's fees due to her, but being able to look at the factors, including a reassessment of some of the actual bad faith that the government participated in during the course of the litigation.
Well, so we ultimately did find out how exactly she got on the list. It's not something the government divulged right away. It took years of litigation. But what was the actual thing that happened that got her on the list?
Well, that's the kicker, is that the form, which is not at all intuitive, was not that you check the box of the list that you're supposed to be on, but the boxes that you are not included on. The agent got this mixed up, and what ensued was a more than decade-long litigation where this woman finally vindicated her ability to travel.
And when you say lists, that's because there's a bunch of different lists that a bunch of different agencies have, right?
You know, J. Ross, we've talked about alphabet soup before on this show, and that is a drowning in that very alphabet soup is a hazard of federal litigation, so much so that the, you know, 100 or whatever acronyms at play here were attached in an appendix to the opinion so that you could get through all the abbreviations for these agencies, for these, you know, different statutes and different sort of federal subdivisions.
Yeah, it's, you know, you're talking about alphabet soup. We had something similar happen to our client in Houston forfeiture. That's a case where this American nurse was traveling to Nigeria with $41,000 to set up a medical clinic there. And Customs and Border Patrol officers took her money and sent her on her way to Nigeria. One of the interesting things that happened to her was when she was coming back from Nigeria, Customs and Border Protection officers stopped her again and put her into a separate line where she had to go through, and they basically screened her in a very special way. They ruined her bag. And then one of the officers looked at her and he said, "You're the lady who had her money taken. Now you'll have to go through this every single time you travel." So she tells this to us. We don't even know what to do about this. We, you know, try to contact government agents to ask them whether she's on some sort of a list. And they're telling us, you can't really know whether she's on the list or not. You can try to apply to be removed from a list that you think you're on, but we're not going to tell you whether you're on that list or not, right? And there are multiple lists when it comes to Customs and Border Protection. There are also multiple lists when it comes to TSA. And till this day, we're still kind of not able to figure out why Antonia can't travel without being specially screened every time.
It seems like it wouldn't be hard to come up with some good security reasons, national security reasons, why you wouldn't want to tell people if they were on a list. But on the other hand of the ledger, you know, the government's kind of really like kind of bumbling behavior in this case where they like completely accidentally put someone on a list and then don't admit it for years over the course of litigation. Like, what do you make of that?
Well, just think what this does to someone's life. I mean, for a grad student who was determined to be no security threat, to be denied the ability to engage in air travel in the U.S. is really crippling, which is why attorney's fees, which seem like sort of an ancillary side issue with this kind of case, are really important, because how else could someone like this vindicate their rights when they're up against the federal government other than having a fee-shifting law? And, you know, Antonia was incredibly lucky to be represented by us here at IJ, but for people who either don't have the resources to litigate these cases or who aren't part of a public interest lawsuit, it can really leave people in a lurch.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, they couldn't represent her other than this kind of an arrangement, right, where they basically would recover attorney's fees. And the court basically said 90% of what they deserved, they couldn't recover.
So what was the argument about? So obviously she won if her lawyers are going to get attorney's fees. So what was this the stage of the litigation about?
Well, the lower court had a more narrow reading of what the fees were that she was entitled to. And the Ninth Circuit took a look at that ruling and also at the entire course of the litigation, not just the issues where she won or the claims that were the claims she prevailed on in her trial, but looked at the conduct of the government over the course of the entire case and thought that that was something that the trial court needed to take another look at and to look at as a whole.
It's unusual to see such scathing language from judges about the government's conduct over the course of a case.
It is unusual. They describe the discovery tactics as games, which is unusual, although sadly not uncommon, as we experience in some of our cases here at IJ, where we are often challenging entire government programs that have information that is something that the government doesn't want to turn over, but nevertheless has to. And I think that the other aspect of this is just the egregiousness of a mistake that the government knew about all along and nevertheless fought the student every step of the way. And that's something that has to come into account when you think about who's going to pay for the lawsuit. So it was unusual, but the facts were also unusual.
Well, were they unusual if the government's often engaging in this kind of shenanigans with discovery? And the follow-up question is, is this going to be precedential? Are people going to be able to take this case and say, hey, this kind of discovery games are going on in our case?
I think what brought this to another level was that from day one, there wasn't even a sort of colorable claim that the government could make. It was just a complete dead wrong listing of this woman on a no-fly list. And to continue to defend it through the years, knowing that, there's something unconscionable.
Okay, and with that, we'll move on to the next case, which comes out of the Sixth Circuit. Anya?
Sure. And that's actually, another kind of case where the court, the Sixth Circuit, was really upset with the behavior by government officials and used some amazing language. And I will try to quote from it maybe a bit later, if occasion allows. But the case is about the Flint water crisis. We all know about it. And this horrible thing that happened in 2014 when, as a cost-saving measure, city officials in Flint decided to switch water source from Lake Huron to the Flint River. Flint River, and they knew that was, much more corrosive. And it turns out now that it's 19 times more corrosive than Lake Huron. And they didn't even use chemicals to make sure that there was no lead in the water. So what happened later is that a lot of kids started to become ill from lead poisoning. And now we have this case where city officials and state officials are being sued by parents of children saying that they violated these kids and their substantive due process rights to bodily integrity. And both the district court and the Sixth Circuit agree with that and deny the government's motion to dismiss. And the government motion to dismiss was essentially based on two arguments. The first one, qualified immunity, and the second one, sovereign immunity. What's very encouraging about this case is that it kind of goes out on a limb when it comes to qualified immunity and really engages with the facts. It doesn't just dismiss, doesn't just grant motion to dismiss on qualified immunity, but actually says, we know about this clearly established test, but the facts are so outrageous that we actually think that there really isn't necessarily a need for a very similar factual circumstances precedent for us to say that it is clearly established and you don't overcome qualified immunity. Speaking of qualified immunity and colorful language, here, I think I've got it right here. The court says, government officials stripped the very essence of personhood from those who consumed the water. They also caused parents to strip their children of their own personhood. If ever there was an egregious violation of the right to bodily integrity, this is the case. The affront to human dignity in this case is compelling. So these are very powerful words, and I'm very happy to see a court go this far.
Anya is one of our resident experts on qualified immunity. Have you noticed this as part of any trend in the case law or any direction that these types of cases are going?
We've definitely noticed, especially in the district courts, some of the judges going out of their way and saying, we're not going to be tied to this very strict test where you actually have to find precedent that's, fact to fact similar to the situation that's happening here. And there are also circuit court judges, and I'm sure you guys talked in the short circuit a lot about Judge Willett, who are also going out of their way to make their position clear that qualified immunity is becoming an insurmountable barrier, and that's just not the right way to go. So Supreme Court will have to weigh in at some point.
Well, so I want to talk about sovereign immunity, but first, there's a dissent in the case who says more or less, like, what the heck is this right to bodily integrity?
Right. This is very, very interesting. And the court, actually, its main precedent for recognizing this right to bodily integrity is the case out of the Sixth Circuit. I think it's called Cincinnati Radiation. And there, what happened was they were experimenting on cancer patients and were giving them an unusual amount of radiation to see how military personnel would fare in a nuclear war situation. And it's amazing to actually see judges comparing this case with Cincinnati Radiation. But they basically say, hey, this is, you know, like stripping somebody of personhood. This is a right to bodily integrity. And of course, there is a substantive due process to be in control of your body and to know what's going on with it.
How old is Cincinnati Radiation? Hopefully not too recent.
Not too recent, but not, you know, old enough.
So Anya, we talk about qualified immunity a ton on this show, but in this case, we have something called sovereign immunity, which is a little different. Well, it's a lot different, but tell us what it is and where it comes from.
Sure. Sovereign immunity is very different from qualified immunity. When it comes to qualified immunity, it's all about suing individual officials, right? Sovereign immunity is about suing the state, and it comes from the 11th Amendment. And what the 11th Amendment says is that you cannot use federal courts to sue states, period. And really, sovereign immunity is very broad, and it's non-controversial to say that states cannot be sued in federal court. There is a really cool case before the U.S. Supreme Court right now, but it doesn't involve being sued in a federal court. It actually involves state suing state in a state court, which is very different. So in this case, sovereign immunity is very broad. You can't sue a state. So the question is, who can really take advantage of this broad sovereign immunity? If you're a state, sure, but can somebody else? So in this situation, the city of Flint tried to take advantage of this broad concept of sovereign immunity. It said, listen, in this situation, we were an arm of the state. Therefore, we also are allowed sovereign immunity. Why were they arm of the state? Because at the time, the state, pursuant to its emergency powers, essentially took over the governance of the city of Flint. But the court didn't buy it here. And the court didn't buy it in the next case that we're going to discuss.
Well, let's back up a second. So in Flint, the city is in financial distress. So some of its operations or all of its operations have been taken over by the state.
Right.
So that, I mean, that sounds like at least a colorable argument. If indeed that the state is behind the helm of the decision to switch the water source.
One of the easiest way to be recognized as an arm of a state is when a state would be liable financially, liable in courts for your behavior as a city. That's not the case here, right? If somebody were to bring a suit for damages against the city would be on the hook for it. And that's probably the easiest way to be recognized as an arm of the state, and it just doesn't work here.
Okay, Rob, that's a great transition to our final case, sovereign immunity, also a big part of this case. Take it away.
So this case comes out of the Eighth Circuit, and this was interesting because we saw sovereign immunity as part of a litigation strategy. This was a lawsuit brought as a class action against the city of Ferguson, Missouri, for their practice of detaining people for fines, something that we are a practice, I should say, we're familiar with here at IJ with our, for example, class action against Pagedale, Missouri. In any event, this was at the very early stages of the case where there was a motion to dismiss that the government brought and it was denied. Typically, at that early stage, the case goes on. There's nothing that you can take up to an appellate court. But there's an exception to that rule when you have a claim for sovereign immunity. So what Ferguson did was not make a claim for itself, but on behalf of the municipal courts who were part of this system of issuing the fines and the detentions. Well, the court sort of saw through this and said, look, this
not is the municipal court, the Sixth Circuit.
The Sixth Circuit. Yes,
or the Eighth the Circuit. Excuse me, the Eighth
Sorry.
Circuit.
Yeah. So the Eighth Circuit was able to cut through this and say, this suit has to go forward. You can't say that there's sovereign immunity for someone, in this case, that someone being the municipal courts, who's not even a party to the lawsuit, which is understandable because bringing in a court system as a party to a constitutional class action is something very difficult, but is something that has happened only a handful of times, one of which was one of our IJ cases, Philadelphia forfeiture, where we were successfully able to have the First Judicial District as a party to a class action. So it is certainly something rare, but not something here where just sort of pointing your finger at a non-party court system would let you continue with your appeal.
Yeah, so here it doesn't even pretend, the city is not even pretending like it doesn't Flint, that it's an arm of the state, right? It's just basically bringing in a state entity and is trying to take advantage of the sovereign immunity doctrine.
So the city is saying, hey, you need... In addition to suing city officials over our practice of fining people and then throwing them in jail when they can't pay until their friends and relatives cough up the money, they're saying, oh, you should also be suing our local courts, and our local courts happen to be somewhat related to the state. Therefore, everyone's entitled to sovereign immunity.
Well, in this case, it was therefore we can maintain our appeal and we can stay in the appellate court on what typically would not even be within the appellate court's jurisdiction to hear. If they had granted the motion to dismiss and the case was gone and the parties then had a final judgment, the case could go up on appeal. But when that motion to dismiss is denied and the case goes forward, typically, that's the end of the story, and there's no appellate jurisdiction to hear the case. This would have been an exception to that if you could have gotten a sovereign immunity challenge up to the appellate court, but not for a non-party.
This interlocutory appeal that Rob is talking about is actually very interesting and pops up a lot with the issue of qualified immunity. The Sixth Circuit in the Flint water crisis case talked a bit about it, and it was actually very frustrated how the government filed a motion to dismiss and claimed qualified immunity. And the court basically said, listen, you really shouldn't be doing it here. You should wait for motion for summary judgment when there's at least some evidence, and then maybe we can engage better with the issue. But because it goes on appeal immediately and the government doesn't have to wait for completion of any kind of a proceeding, they claim qualified immunity right away.
So no matter who you are, whether you're the government or a non-party or just going through life, we all want a second bite at the apple.
No, a second bite at the cherry. That makes much more sense. And that was the original saying. You can't actually take a second bite at the cherry, right? At the apple, you can take a third and fourth and fifth bite and so on.
What about the pit, though? I mean, you might have to gnaw around it. I don't know.
This has been non-legal trivia from Anya Bidwell, everyone. It's really, the saying was originally a second bite of the cherry, allegedly.
Nice.
Okay.
Way to, yeah.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, colluding with you to get engaged.